You're listening to Opera Box Score.
Let's get ready to rumble!
Wherever you are, however you're listening, it's America's talk radio show about opera. It's Opera Box Score. I'm George Cedarquist, joined by Matt Cummings, Weston Williams, and Ashley Hardgrave. All right. This week, March Madness is here. We work through a bracket of our own to pick the top school of music in the country.
Ooh.
And then baritone Lucas Meacham, Uncle Lucas, returns to the OBS to take a free throw on developing young voices and how to decide on where one should get their undergraduate degree if they want to make it to the pros. Plus, two-minute drill. Malfunctions at the Met lead to making lemonade out of lemons. That is at the end of the podcast. Make sure you subscribe on Spotify. You click follow. Apple Podcasts, hit the plus sign. You can always just send us that voice memo, even just email us your hot takes, mailbag@operaboxscore.com. Even record your thoughts using the You Got Something to Say tab on the website, operaboxscore.com. Hey, however you contribute and get your voice heard, you're going to get the OBS beer coaster, the OBS lapel pin, and that number one OBS fan foam finger just for sharing your own hot take. I just gave away one of those today, and I brought joy.
Joy.
To somebody.
Just like Santa Claus.
Or Marie Kondo.
I'm happy that we're all here today, including Matt Cummings.
Yes, that's true. I'm back from getting some sun, and I brought my binoculars with me because what's that? On the horizon? Oh, it's Olympics watch. It's an Olympics watch update. And not even the one that you thought it would be, because it's the farther Olympics. It's the Winter Olympics update.
Oh, jeez.
Who has watched any of that video from the Montreal World Championship figure skaters of Ilya Malinin?
Girl.
Oh, my God. The drama of this 19-year-old American figure skating phenom landing a record-setting, record-breaking six quads in his free skate program. And not just did he absolutely nail the execution, he did it to the Succession soundtrack. Like, just the diva. Like, I don't even know what else to call it. Devo, I guess.
No, I feel like Ilya is also a character from a Mozart opera. It is Idomeneo. Right, there we go. So it was meant to be. Weston Williams, how's life?
Just be glad you didn't try to make a Handel opera reference, George.
Yeah, that would
might have not gone well.
I would have wiped
you
out on the ice on that. Yikes. Okay, moving on. Ashley Hardgrave, back from China. Do you know what day it is?
I don't, you guys. I don't. I got back many days ago, and until yesterday, my body thought it was 13 hours ahead the next day. Like, I woke up Saturday morning and my body was like, it's 4 a.m. Sunday. Like, I can't.
The first time I tried to do jet lag like that, I was like, they say it's an hour per time zone that you cross, but surely that's an exaggeration. It is not. Ladies and gentlemen, it is not.
Who knows what in the world I'm going to say tonight? I'm coming in hot as a loose cannon. Good luck to us all, listeners included.
That makes for very good radio. Let's talk some opera.
Chalk Talk on Opera Box Score.
It's that time of year again. It's March Madness. We're going to do something a little different. Sometimes we use that patented OBS approach to pick a winner of the actual, say, Women's World Cup or men's basketball playoffs in the NCAA. We're going to do something a little bit different this year. Yes, we're going to use a bracket.
Don't worry about that.
But we're going to pick the best school of music in the country. We've got metrics, including the size of the programs, how long it's been around, its alums, its facilities, the repertoire that it's producing. We might even have to look at a fight song or two as a tiebreaker. We've got a bracket of 16 teams. I hope PJ can get that up on the website. In the meantime, tonight we're going to look at the South and the Midwest regions. Matt Cummings, our judge for these four matchups between eight schools. And we're going to start with a matchup from Florida State and Houston. Weston, you're backing Florida State. Take it away.
It pains me to back Florida State because, you know, as a dyed-in-the-wool, Southerner from the heart of Dixie, Florida doesn't really count as part of the southern region, but I guess geographically I am forced to kind of take this position. Now, as George discovered, to part the curtain here a little bit, he was thinking about a completely different school than I was thinking of, because Florida has way too many dang universities in it. But that's okay, because the one I was talking about was Florida State University College of Music, which I think is legitimate to talk about because it's actually the third largest music university program in the entire country.
Jeez.
Certainly the largest in the Southeast. It has 700 undergrads and 400 graduate students at the school, which is pretty big. Big, big orchestral music focus to this school, a lot of instrumentalists specifically. But even though I'm saying that, it's actually got a fairly large, you know, association with opera. The school technically celebrated centennial back in 2011, although arguably you could say it really started back in 1901, because that's when the first sort of music teacher came and sort of started to form the department. It became a separate College of Music only in 2005, though. So if you're trying to keep track of that score at home, just give up. They're actually kind of a pioneer in the music therapy field. It's been kind of a focus of theirs since they opened their first program for music therapy back in 1954. Let's talk alumni. We have a few good ones here. We've got mezzo Brenda Boozer. We got composer Sarah Hutchings, tenor Frank Kelly, soprano Stella Zambales, and friend of the show, Ryan Speedo Green, who should be, I think, sufficient for, like, you know, to get us through the next round just on the sports cred alone, you know. In terms of faculty, a lot of great former faculty. Carlisle Floyd actually taught here for a long time. In fact, his opera Susanna actually premiered on campus, which I did not know. Ernst von Dohnányi also taught here while he was alive, the great sort of composer and conductor. Tenor Stanford Olson, coloratura soprano Yvonne Regina Cianella was here as a member of the faculty. In terms of current staff, it's not quite as heavy on the opera notables. They do have Ellen Toft-Swillich, who is really cool because she's the first woman to win the Pulitzer Prize for music, but it's less relevant for us because she notably has not done any operas, and I don't think is planning to. But if she does, then we can...
We'll be the first to know.
Yeah, exactly. But it's more of a mid-tier kind of school. It's got a really big budget, but that is kind of spread out among its very, very massive student base, which can have some, you know, advantages and disadvantages. In terms of public schools, it's one of the better ones. Many grads do go on to competitive apprenticeship programs and competitions. So all in all, it's a pretty solid school. And, you know, in terms of size, I mean, you know, if we're talking quantity over quality and even including quality, it's definitely got some heft in the region.
Well, there's no question that my school that I'm backing, Houston, is definitely the underdog in this matchup. So the University of Houston, this is the Moores School of Music, founded in 1940. I'm going to keep this short and sweet, and we got some heavy hitting going on. So alums, Denise Graves,
nice.
Suzanne Menser, and Carlisle Floyd went to Florida State. Carlisle Floyd went to the University of Houston, I'll have you know. The Houston Grand Opera Studio was first formed in 1977. Through 1992, it was in partnership with the Moores School of Music. So the initial, what is this, almost 20 years of that program was in collaboration between HGO and the Moores School of Music. That alone, I think, makes this a competitive matchup. Matt, what do you say?
You know, Florida State got into this bracket by the skin of its teeth in an upset over the Frost School of Music at University of Miami, and it's certainly not due to any clerical errors. And you know what? I think that that little underdog has what it takes to go on into the next round. Houston, a great school, maybe gets a little bit overlooked by because it shares a city with another school that's going to get a little bit of attention later on. And it's a great music program, but Florida State has got momentum and it knows how to make the conversion.
Let's move over then to the Midwest bracket. So this is, again, a one seed against a four seed. Indiana University, which Ashley's going to talk about, against the Oberlin College, which is my team. Ashley, what do you got?
First of all, is this even a match? I would like to say, be advised, I am a former music admissions dean. I am a current art school consultant working with families on finding the right music and art and theater school for their kids. So I have feelings about all of this. And best school is subjective, and all of these schools need to overhaul their curriculum for this century, include business and entrepreneurship classes. I am available for curriculum design. Call me. However, let's get to Michigan. I'm sorry, Indiana. Indiana, the Jacobs School of Music, otherwise known as, come on, guys. Come on. Okay, let's talk about the size of the school. Jacobs School of Music itself. It's this little, like, conservatory-ish gem. And by little, I don't mean little. It's 1,500 students. But it's within this major public university. All 50 states are represented. 50-plus countries are represented. It is the second largest enrollment of all NASM music schools in the U.S. Now, NASM means less than it used to, but it's still a thing in some places. In terms of its, you know, lifespan, it's 103 years old. It was established in 1921. It constantly gets honors, being ranked first in things like Change Magazine, Chronicle of Higher Ed, U.S. News World Reports. The music school is listed first among the top 10 voice schools in America by Classical Singer Magazine. IU students from Jacobs often are at the top of the list when it comes to Metropolitan National Council winners. They have had 5 grand winners in the last 5 years. It's also, you know, got 20 students, which is apparently unparalleled in terms of receiving the BMI Student Composition Awards. And in April 81, the opera program became the first non-professional company to stage an opera at the Met. Let's talk about their alumni. Sylvia McNair, Larry Brown.
How much time do you have?
Literally everybody else. Like, I know. We don't have time. We do not have time. I know as a singer, when I was coming up, Jacobs was the place to be. Jacobs is where it's at. When I was working as a music admissions dean, one of my biggest competitors in terms of nabbing good singers was Jacobs. This is just how it goes. In terms of current faculty, again, I say to you, come on. Carol Vaness, Sylvia McNair, Heidi Grant Murphy, Michelle DeYoung, Russell Thomas, Tashina Vaughn. As far as reputation goes, it's Indiana. It's Jacobs. It's Indiana Jacobs. The overall acceptance rate in this program is 25% for undergrads and 30% for graduates. Now, that seems broad, but arguably the voice department is much, much more exclusive. But they didn't have those acceptance rates published. By the way, acceptance rates for schools, don't use those to hedge your bets. Again, higher ed admissions professional here. Talk to me. I will give you better get better ways and better metrics. But at the same time, this is Indiana. Good luck, Oberlin.
Well, we're going to need it, certainly. There's no question, again, that Oberlin, the underdog here. I love this border war as well. Oberlin just across the state line in that sleepy little college town of Oberlin, Ohio. It's a very competitive school to get in. You can take your 25 and your 30%. 10% is around the admission rate here at the Oberlin Conservatory of Music, founded in 1865. And can I just name drop here? William Grant Still.
Oh, that's okay. Cool.
The Dean of African American Composers, as he's known, a Oberlin grad. I'll be honest and say that opera is just one of many offerings here. Alums include composer Du Yun. Apparently, Denise Graves also went to Oberlin, as well as
Unstoppable.
She sure did. Marilyn Horn on the faculty as well earlier on in her lifetime. It is small. It is scrappy. It is more than opera. Matt, give us a decision.
You know, Oberlin came in with lots of enthusiasm, and we love that for them. But Indiana Jacobs, I mean, it may be a factory at times, but it's a hit factory. You just can't argue with results like this. It's got to go on.
Going back to the South bracket then, this is the 2-seed Rice, backed by Weston, against my 3-seed, the University of North Texas. Weston, make that case.
The Shepherd School of Music, kind of a powerhouse. I will say this is a Houston-based school. It's got that benefit of being in the same city as you know, the HGO. Let's talk about longevity here. So technically, the funding for the school was done back in 1955, but the school itself didn't actually officially open until 75. And I don't know exactly if there was like no music school, no music students going on in that those 20 years. But in any case, the school itself officially started in 75. So it's fairly new compared to some of the ones you've been hearing that have been around for 100 years. However, the college website presents itself, and I think fairly, as the youngest of the heavy hitters of the music school world in the U.S., which I think means that, you know, maybe some of its historical alumni and professors might not be as impressive as other places, but it certainly has, but I think you also have less baggage, you know. It's very easy to be like, Carlisle Floyd, you know, taught here or was an alumni here, but that was, you know, 3,000 years ago when Carlisle Floyd was in his teens and 20s. So let's talk about some of the alumni really quickly. Again, more recent sort of figures. We have conductor James Gaffigan, Venezuelan conductor Efrain Amaya. You've got Gabriela Lena Frank, the composer, who I'm a fan of. Caroline Shaw went here, you know, the savior of classical music herself. And, of course, Kate Soper went here, which, you know, if you know, you know, and I do know. Honestly, great women composers who are all powerhouses in their own right and all tiptoeing into that opera area. They're all younger composers. I'm sure there are singers of note, but I had a lot of trouble finding them. I attribute this in part to the fact that it is a somewhat younger school compared to some, and the fact that they just recently, in 2020, finally built their opera hall in addition to the concert hall they already had. I think there's a sort of an increased sort of focus on opera in recent years that means that most of their notable alumni are pretty young. Kareem Suleiman also went here, I should note. Yay. They do have some voice faculty, Robin Rice, Nova Thomas, and Ana Maria Martinez, who is quite a big deal. In terms of reputation, it's an extremely competitive program. They only have about 30-something opera-focused students at any given time, but they still manage to pull off two operas a year with a full orchestra, which is pretty nice. Students do get a lot of attention because it's a smaller program, and they definitely have a lot of ambition. I mean, the fact that they built an enormous new concert hall that could accommodate operas within the past 4 years means that they are definitely investing in its future. So, like I said, maybe not as big of a long history as some of the places we're talking about over the next week or two, but it's definitely an upcoming juggernaut in many ways. And I think that speaks for itself.
I will say that opera house they've just built at Rice is absolutely gorgeous.
Yeah, I saw pictures. Oh, it's stunning.
I just was drooling over those pics. So University of North Texas, the three seed here, really, in my opinion, really known as like a jazz program, right? Like the University of North Texas, like the 1 o'clock jazz combo is like nationally renowned, but they do have an opera program. It's founded in 1944 and is one of many divisions within the School of Music, currently run by Jonathan Eaton, who's been there since 2017. Patricia Rossett, a graduate of UNT, and also Latonya Moore as well. Fabulous singer, too. Beyond that, I don't know what to say other than like small and scrappy and part of a great tradition of music making.
This on paper looks like it should be a blowout, but it's really surprisingly close because the singers coming out of UNT are just pretty consistently rather excellent. And so I think that in the end, They're gonna squeak out the win here.
Wow.
A little upset. A shutout for the city of Houston.
Yeah. Exactly. Okay, we hop back to the Midwest then, the two versus three. Ashley's got the two seed in the University of Michigan, and I've got the three seed in Cincinnati Conservatory of Music.
You know, it's really funny. I thought as a townie, George would be really excited to take on the University of Michigan, but I think he's wanted to stretch his wings a little bit and try to represent some other places. So I've got the distinct pleasure of taking on the University of Michigan, which is otherwise known as, no, I'm not here for musical theater. So when we look at the University of Michigan, it has, you know, it's broken up into these different schools, like a lot of these places are. Every org structure is different in all of these schools. But for University of Michigan, it's all about the School of Music, Theater, and Dance. When you look at that school as a whole, which also includes the very famous musical theater department, it also has 1,500 students. Wow. So the voice department's going to be a little bit smaller than what we find over in Jacobs, but not by much. When we look at the history of the MTD, the music department was established in 1880. The music school was originally independent of the university. But Michigan itself, you know, it's been around for a while. It did absorb the music school eventually. It's one of the earliest American research universities. It's also one of the most selective, if not the most selective, public research universities in the country. Let's talk about alumni. Again, how much time you got? But a couple of the hits that would be notable to people these days. Jesse Norman, Ashley Putnam, conductor Mayan Chen, who is a hometown hero here, Michael Fabiano, Madonna is an alum.
Hey, Evita is a rock opera.
Absolutely. She's allowed to stay. When it comes to modern faculty, again, how much time you got? Let's listen to this list. Thomas Hampson, Amanda Majeski, Louise Toppin, George Shirley.
Yeah.
Legendary George Shirley.
Barrier breaker himself.
Let's talk about this reputation for University of Michigan. Again, nice enough, but who's here for musical theater? Okay, listen. Yes, it is a bit of an opera powerhouse. There's some really incredible folks that have come through Michigan's opera doors in the last few years. But when we're really looking at sort of the macro reputation of Michigan when it comes to visual and performing arts, it's a modern Broadway factory. So anytime that you're looking at a playbill, if you're seeing a national tour, if you're lucky enough to be on Broadway, take a look in those bios. You will... Don't take a drink every time you see the word Michigan, because you will be hammered before Act Two. But the thing here about reputation is really, again, going back to this selectivity of the research university itself, because it is housed within that. The acceptance rates here is they're absolutely bonkers. You have to be able to get into academically the University of Michigan to go. And when we're looking at those stats, we're talking, this is some numbers on last year's freshman class. These are specifically within the School of Music, Theater, and Dance. These are the academics for those students. A 30 average ACT, a 1346 average SAT, and a 3.76 GPA. So those are the averages for the performing artists that are coming through those doors. So not only are these people incredible performers, they've also got lots of brains as well. So put all those things together, you've really got a heavy hitter in the University of Michigan's School of Music, Theater, and Dance.
And yet George somehow was associated with them.
Yeah.
Yeah,
you're right. CCM pretty much sucks, and I think Michigan should win this.
It all makes sense why he wanted CCM now.
You are awful.
CCM really doesn't have anything going for it, so I think we can just probably move on and just give this to here's what University of Cincinnati College Conservatory of Music, try saying that after three gin and tonics, alums, Kathleen Battle, Stephen Flaherty, the Broadway
half of Aaron's and Flaherty.
Exactly. Tamara Wilson. Here's what I really do think is unique about CCM is that in its opera program, it has a whole separate wing, which is called Opera Fusion, New Works, OFNW. So this is run by Robin Guarino, a fantastic director, in collaboration with Evans Miragiris, who runs Cincinnati Opera. And it has developed 12 new American operas, including The Hours, Hadrian, Intimate Apparel, Fellow Travelers, Champion, and Doubt. I mean, these are shows which are starting to do the rounds now. And so you're having students, you're having designers, you're having instrumentalists getting their hands on these works at very early stages. For me, that's what makes the opera portion of a much larger powerhouse at CCM so relevant.
The Michigan-Ohio rivalry is table stakes here. Two excellent schools, like really two titans of musical and higher musical education squaring off here. I think that the new works program is going to give CCM the edge to knock Michigan out.
Amazing.
Just because the development of what have been really successful and well-received new works that have been performed not just once, but many times, like Champion and Fellow Travelers, is the mark of a successful pilot program like that. And I think we should reward that sort of risk-taking.
I've never seen someone so disappointed to win before in my life, George.
That had no bearing on my decision-making. But it is an added bonus.
So we need to get one of these teams from the South into the Final Four. Weston backed Florida State. I backed the University of North Texas. Matt Cummings is going to be the person. He knows everything there is to know based on Weston and Mai's arguments. Matt, put somebody into the Final Four from the South Division.
Florida State has been having a Cinderella story so far, but I think her luck has run out. UNT is going to advance into the Final Four.
Fantastic. So sad.
We head down to the Midwest. Ashley's Hoosiers against my, what are they? Bearcats.
The Bearcats.
Yes, the Bearcats.
I got something to say, okay? The March Madness, it's all about the upsets, okay? But that's for the beginning rounds. The time for upsets is over. This is Indiana Jacobs School of Music. This is the UConn, men's and women's of music schools. I just needed that out there.
You know, when she's right, she's right. I've always said that about Ashley. The Jacobs School of Music is just too much of a juggernaut to be stopped, even by an institution as wonderful as the University of Cincinnati College Conservatory of Music. That Opera Village, that may be what it takes to raise a child, but it's not enough to topple Jacobs.
I turned off the OBS TV channel as soon as Michigan was out anyway. So, all right, two teams into the Final Four. Next week, we're going to look at a very crowded East bracket. Oh my gosh, was it tough to make it into the top four seeds there? And then the West, where things, there's a little more space, upset potential. You're going to want to let us know what you're thinking as well. Let us know about your school. How does it stack up? Where should it be in the bracket? Mailbag@operaboxscore.com.
Free throw.
Lucas Meacham returns to Chicago next month to perform the title role in Mendelssohn's oratorio Elijah with the Chicago Symphony Chorus and Orchestra. He gave a full-length interview for WFMT, which airs this Saturday, and he had a few minutes to give to our free throw.
Welcome back to Opera Box Score, Lucas. We were just recording an interview for WFMT. Because of your return to Chicago, you're going to sing Elijah with Chicago Symphony Orchestra. And you had mentioned that when you were a student, your teacher gave you It Is Enough as an aria to work on. And it just made me think, like, oh my God, how many times have coaches and teachers given their students, you know, things to work on that they're never going to be able to fully perform or fully inhabit until much later on in their lives. I think of an aria like Piangero, which, you know, every soprano gets this thing, you know, it's like some 18-year-old girl singing Piangero, like what? And of course, like, you know, it's like it's Handel, so it's light. And like, you know, there's some things to be learned about technique and about whatever form and blah, you know. But I don't expect an 18-year-old to be able to understand what that piece really means and how, you know, what Cleopatra is going through and how to express that with their very, you know, young technique. Similarly with It Is Enough, you said you got this piece in college?
Yeah, well, it's an interesting subject you bring up, though, because it's kind of, I won't say it's old school, but the way voice teachers used to teach is you would have a voice teacher and we would live near that voice teacher and work almost every day with that voice teacher, and they wouldn't let you move on past singing an ah vowel for a few years, basically, until you figured out exactly what your technique was and how to sing it. And these days it's changed a lot. And the fact that a lot of young singers are more gung-ho to learn new pieces. And a lot of singers are, a lot of their teachers want to give them new repertoire as well so that they can begin to stretch their emotional imaginations. Like when you give someone a piece that is very deep and heady, I kind of think it's important to stretch one's imagination, stretch this young singer's imagination. I say it's less safe to stretch them vocally into a Fach or register or vocal category that is a little too heavy for them in the moment. For instance, any sort of Verdi or Wagner for an 18-year-old should absolutely be verboten. And so it's an interesting thing. It's an interesting subject. But for me to be given this piece, It Is Enough, when I was a young singer, I have to say I enjoyed it as a young singer because, you know, I had a lighter, smaller sound. And I was able to kind of croon it a little bit in a way that felt nice. It taught me so much, though. I learned from not being able to do it well. I learned so much. You know, I learned how to spin a beautiful legato phrase. What he was saying is just so incredibly emotional. I learned how to really move forward in the dynamic and backward in the dynamic, and learned how to float the voice a bit, because at the end, he really just sort of shouts at the sky, "It is enough." And then he repeats it. And it says a subito piano right there. And then he goes, "It is enough." And to hear that, you have to really make those huge differences in sound. So I learned a lot from it. Whether it was too soon or not, I probably agree with you. But I learned a lot from the mistakes I made in it.
You bring up a good point, because Mendelssohn is an interesting composer. Clearly in the Romantic era and requiring, you know, for lack of a better word, like a bel canto technique to perform this music. But also there's rhetoric in it, so that the singer, the artist, has to make decisions. And I think, you know, when music forces you to think, it does force you to make a choice and, like, you know, think, oh, I need to change the color, I need to change the volume or something, you know. So that is useful. Yeah. Especially since it's in English, and you know, let's be real, like most American singers, when they're still in college, they only speak English.
Yeah, of course. It was low hanging fruit for my 18-year-old self.
We are getting onto a topic at Opera Box Score about the institutions of learning singing in the U.S. Without naming names, unless you want to advocate for one, do you have something to say in general about where people learn how to sing and what they can get from the experience, and maybe what's missing from the experience?
Wow, this is a big can of worms.
Well, you
happy
are
to dig into this.
You are Uncle Lucas to all of us singers who follow you. Oh. On Instagram.
I'll take it. I love that. Uncle Lucas. Oh my God. That's going to be I'm going to change my Instagram name to Uncle Lucas. All right. Well, let's get into it. It's such a huge subject. I do get asked a lot for advice about what college to choose and where to go, how to decide. And for the most part, what I say is, should I start with why I say it? I'll start with why I say it. First of all, the human voice takes so long to develop, so long to mature, that you have a lot of time that as a young singer, you know, when you're 18 years old, a year is a lot of time. When you're 45, a year is just a little bit of time, you know, and you sort of have a bit more perspective. So my point in saying that is a four-year institution for an 18-year-old seems like the longest amount of time they could possibly imagine. They need to be accomplishing something. When I tell them, you need to incubate in your undergrad. You need to grow at not too quick a pace, not too slow a pace, at whatever pace your voice goes. Because when you get out at 22, you're not going to start, I won't say anything, but you're not going to start very much professionally. So you really need to just wait. And it's the hardest thing to do as a singer is just wait and just take your time moving into something. So I tell people, go to a nice, easy, small undergrad. And then when you're, especially people that might not come from money or might have other financial considerations, that where you really want to spend your time and efforts is grad school. that's when you really need the best teacher you can possibly get, the best coaches you could possibly get, the best acting, the best conducting, the best things you can get. And I won't go into details about which schools I think are great at that, but it's a journey, this opera one, and it's a marathon, not a sprint, which makes it very difficult for you become so impatient. I remember myself. I'll give a quick example. I was singing for my voice teacher at the Eastman School of Music. I must have been 23 years old. And I sang some Lieder. I remember it was probably one of the Schumann Kärntner Lieder. And he said, "Lucas, that was perfect." And I'd been listening to recordings of people that were like giants in my mind of the opera world, giants of the baritone range. And I finally pushed back and I said, "I'm not perfect. I don't sound like Bryn Terfel. I don't sound like Cappuccilli, who I wasn't, but the recordings I was listening to, I don't sound like I don't sound like these guys." And he said, "Lucas, you're a perfect 23-year-old baritone." And I needed to hear that, because in the moment I was singing perfectly with my voice. And so many young singers I hear these days, they have this beautiful instrument that is uniquely their own, and then they want to add something because they don't trust that their sound is enough. I tell them all, they have this, their own, like we have a fingerprint. You have your own unique vocal print. And what makes you special is that you only sound like yourself. If you attempt to sound like somebody else, or to make your sound bigger than it is, or to make a sound that is not 100% you, you're literally taking away from what makes you special. What makes famous people famous? Famous singers. They only sound like themselves. I'd say that is the biggest thing that makes famous singers famous, is their uniqueness. They sound like themselves. And I urge every young singer out there listening to this to always trust your gut, go with yourself, and choose you over anyone else.
And when you find yourself in the place just right, 'twill be in the valley of love and delight.
Simple Gifts, performed by Lucas Meacham with the Classical Tahoe Orchestra, conducted by Ruth Reinhardt. Be sure to check out Listening to Singers on WFMT Saturday, March 30. And look for Lucas Meacham's YouTube channel at LucasMeacham1, where he shares many insider looks at our industry. Thanks again to Uncle Lucas for taking the time, and thanks to Primo Artists for clearing some space on his calendar for us.
This just in, the 2-minute drill.
All right, listen up. Here's everything you need to know about what happened in Opera Land this week.
When a stage elevator malfunctioned at a Met performance of Turandot last week, the show had to go on, but not in the way the ticket holders were expecting. "I'm sorry to say that this is not going to be a normal night at the opera," said General Manager Peter Gelb at the top of the show, going on to say that the company was ready to perform for you in what will be an historic first, a semi-stage presentation of Turandot at the Met. Some audience members opted for refunds, but those who stayed received a rare encore of Nessun Dorma from tenor Sukjong Bak.
Medici TV has announced a new partnership with the public library app Hoopla Digital to provide patrons with free streams of concerts and operas. Said Hoopla Digital founder Jeff Janowski, quote, "As libraries evolve to meet patrons' demand for digital media, our growing binge pass offerings enable libraries to provide diverse streaming content to their patrons with ease and in the format that patrons are accustomed to."
In an update to a story from last week, the musicians of the San Francisco Symphony have released an open letter calling on the board of directors to convince Esa-Pekka Salonen to stay as music director. Quote, "The decision to cut innovative programming and cancel touring, as well as the failure to competitively invest in the symphony's musicians, has led to the departure of a world-class maestro and raises serious questions about the future of the symphony."
Ukrainian conductor Oksana Leniv has announced she does plan to conduct Tosca at Wiesbaden's May Festival, despite the fact that Anna Netrebko will be making an appearance in Turandot. Leniev previously threatened to cancel a performance in Vienna due to the participation of Teodor Kudenzis due to his connections to Russia. Quote, "The situation is different. I was invited to Wiesbaden as part of the entire Tosca production from Bologna," said Leniev. "I would very much like the intendants to take moral responsibility for their decisions and defend European values for which Ukrainians are currently fighting and dying."
This just in, La Scala musicians support septuagenarians. Ooh. That's the headline, as orchestra members released a letter in support of Dominique Meyer, who was said to be replaced due to a law that makes it illegal for people over the age of 70 to hold government-funded positions. The letter reads, "At this moment, it would be appropriate for the current superintendent and artistic director Dominique Meyer to be able to conclude his term in full capacity. A 2-year extension would allow a valid artistic journey to be fully concluded."
Friend of the show, Arya Nussbaum-Coem, has won top prize at the Goethe Listener Foundation's International Vocal Competition. The countertenor went home with a $15,000 prize. He was joined by first place winner, not to be confused with his top prize winner, baritone Yong Tak Yang, and audience prize winner, soprano Caroline Podolak.
Detroit Opera has announced 5 singers who will train in their resident artist program during the 24-25 season. Soprano Brianna J. Robinson, mezzo Kendra Faith Beasley, baritones Cole Bellamy and Cameron J. Rowling, and returning tenor River Guard. What a good name, River Guard. The resident artists were chosen by associate artistic director, friend of the show, and my vision board BFF, Christine Gerke, and head of music, Natalie Doucette, from more than 830 applicants.
It's a major award. Mongolian baritone Amartushvin Ekbat is the 2024 Premio Bastianini, an honor conferred by the Associazione Ettore Bastianini every 2 years. Previous winners include Luca Salsi, Simone Piazzolla, and Dmitry Vorostovsky.
Crunching the numbers, the Paris Opera has announced a profit for the first time since 2017, thanks to the return of post-pandemic audiences and a record 1.2 million visitors to the Palais Garnier last season. The company reportedly walked away from last year with 2.3 million extra euros in its pocket. General Director Alexander Neef attributed the company's success in part to a 6 million euro increase of state funding between 21 and 23, which, quote, made it possible to partially offset the effects of inflation.
In trade news, bass Kenneth Kellogg will become Seattle Opera's artistic ambassador, advising the company on DEI matters, community partnership, and season planning. Meanwhile, Maggio Musicale Fiorentino has appointed Carlo Fuertes to the position of superintendent.
Exit stage right, Hungarian conductor and composer Peter Ötvös has died at age 80. Ötvös's composition was known for its wide variety of eclectic modern influences. His extensive body of work includes 14 operas, most notably Angels in America, Three Sisters, and Love and Other Demons.
And on this day, March 25th, German composer Johann Adolf Hasse was born in 1699, and Romanian soprano Elena Theodorini was born in Craiova in 1857. 10 years later, 1867 saw the birth of Italian conductor Arturo Toscanini in Parma. And in 1881, we celebrate the birth of Hungarian composer Béla Bartók, as well as the French bass Daniel Vigneault, who was born in Lyon. Italian soprano Magda Olivero was born in 1912 and continued to sing for 175 years. In 1914, American tenor Robert Rounsville was born in Attleboro, Massachusetts. He introduced the song Praise the Lord and Passed the Ammunition at the outbreak of World War II. Composer Julia Perry was born in Lexington, Kentucky in 1924, and in 1928, legendary Italian baritone Mario Sereni was born. In 1944, we celebrate the birth of Slovakian soprano Gabriela Bianochkova. Gilbert and Sullivan's Trial by Jury premiered at the Royalty Theater in 1875, and Jack Beeson's opera Lizzie Borden premiered in New York City on this day in 1965.
That is your 2-minute drill.
Oh,
just heard the marvelous Slovak soprano Gabriela Binačková in the finale from Yenufa. That's from a performance in the Met in 1992 with James Conlon conducting. She has such a beautiful gleam in her voice. But compared with her Slovak compatriots like Lucia Pulp or Edita Gruborova, it's a more substantial instrument. There's a lot of steel in the sound. And she was really able to sing like much bigger repertoire into the Verdi and Verismo. And but really no one could, hardly anyone can touch her in this Czech repertoire. She recorded lots of Janáček operas. She was the first person to ever sing Yenufa at the Met. She was a stalwart of Eve Queller's Opera Orchestra of New York, where she would do things like, you know, Smetana's Libuše. So an artist who you should seek out more recordings of, because she's really, truly wonderful.
Very unusual circumstances at the Met. I am not typically big-hearted towards Peter Gelb. This is, of course, the nightmare, right? Is that you have a big show like that. There's a piece of massive stage machinery show which goes wrong. I assume this is the Zeffirelli production. And
they don't have another one.
They don't, exactly. Well,
what
an
horrible situation.
It's too heavy.
And so, and things start to go wrong, and you know, and you're sort of, you're trying to, you know, make lemonade out of lemons here. But to be like, well, this will be a historic first. It will be a semi-historic.
An historic first, George.
And historic.
It's essentially like going to a Bears game, and after the national anthem, someone comes on the PA and is like, so we're just going to play touch football on this
especially
afternoon.
And like especially for that production of Turandot, which relies so heavily on spectacle. Like, how did they get all of those people to fit onto the stage if they couldn't get the whole throne room scene on there?
It's like I go to a Bears game to see grown men hit each other hard on the gridiron. I go to Turandot, created by Zeffirelli, to see every single thing. I'm not saying I would opt for a refund. I'm not saying I'd walk away. Obviously, that music is phenomenal. You got this rare encore of Nessun Dorma, which has happened, what, two or three times maybe in history? Am I right about that?
Have they investigated the Wokes for sabotaging the stage?
There we go.
Two things to think about here. Number one, point of order on the Bears. Touch football would be more impressive than what the Bears have been putting out the last couple of seasons. I would watch that.
Oof, yeah.
Yes, this happened. Yes, this malfunction happened. Things could have been so much worse with this sort of malfunction. People could have been in danger. We wouldn't have, I mean, they could have just fully shut down and been like, sorry guys, we're not going to do anything else. The only reason they were able to pull off anything that actually happened in the Met that night was because of the unions. So hug a union member, thank a union member. They are the reason that anything else performance related happened that night.
The reason nobody got squished and the reason he got an encore. I mean, it's a pretty good thing on balance.
How about encores for Anna in the in Wiesbaden in May?
I do think that, you know, all of the eyes for this are going to be on Leneve. She is the one who's made the choice to stay. She is the one who's like, look, the reason that I'm staying is because I want everybody to be as uncomfortable as me and my people have been globally for the last however many, what, 2 years? Are we at 2 years at this point? Of that
over,
conflict.
Yeah.
So for her to bow out, I think closes the loop on the story. Her leaning in and showing up and doing her job and doing it really well, as she has been doing all over this globe as of late, I think that furthers the story. I think it amplifies it. I think it raises the narrative. It's going to be uncomfortable, but Oksana's going to come out small and like a rose. Sorry.
Yeah. I mean, she's already getting wonderful press. There's a big feature about her in the New York Times this week that we'll add to our show notes. Just talking about how strong she has been while her family is directly impacted by this war. Her parents and her in-laws live in Odessa, which, like, that's the opening, the nut graph of this, is that a Russian drone had hit a building not far from where her in-laws live. And just the fact that she is such an incredible leader through this all, and not, and I really think that her reasoning for not backing out makes sense, which is that she wasn't invited just as an individual contractor, but that she's part of this entire production and she wants the whole production to be successful. And so she's willing to put herself in a position that is really not fair to be put in. And the strength that it takes to publicly fire back at the festival organizers and say, well, you could do the right thing, in an industry that really, it's so hard to get a foothold. Yeah. As a young woman, as any young conductor, as any young woman, and especially as a young woman conductor, there are so many cards stacked against you. And the fact that she's using her platform to make a statement by like that, like, really speaks to not just her strength, but her leadership. And that is the quality that we need so desperately from the people in those positions.
And if, heaven forbid, something happens and all of a sudden she is suddenly unable to be there or is asked to not be there, guess who looks like a jerk? Not her.
Yeah.
Yep.
It's true. Only the Italians could have some law that prevents people over 70 holding government-funded positions.
Thank God we have an open letter to solve this problem.
We have the double-edged sword of government funding, right? You know, Paris Opera was able to use 6 million euros to become super profitable. But at the same time, you have to abide by rules that you'd normally associate with politicians. Now, I will say I am in a position right now where 70 plus, you have to leave office, feels pretty good to me here in America right now. But I do think that, you know, it is a bit of a, it does feel like kind of a silly and arbitrary rule in this case. The orchestra members are even making the argument that the pandemic years don't count. Like, that's literally in the, which I think is, I feel as someone
talk
who experienced their 20s.
Talk about tapping into the general zeitgeist.
Well, this was my question, is when exactly was this law written? Because like 70.
It's pretty recent.
2023, actually. So
yeah, it's
what?
Very recent. Yeah. That's what makes it so surprising, right? Yeah. It feels
this
like.
This is an inside job. Someone's trying to get him out.
It's him specifically. You know, some countries get funding for their arts program. And some people have to deal with retiring at a reasonable time. So I'll let you pick which country you'd prefer to be in.
I would like to be in one that has a library system.
Oh, yes.
Specifically
too.
One.
There's the transition.
That has a library system that uses Hoopla Digital. That's Hoopla with a lowercase h, if you can't tell.
I love this this idea. I don't know that much about Hoopla. I am
Hoopla Digital.
And I think that libraries are incredibly, incredibly important. I think a lot of people above a certain age who do not have a library card might have this notion that libraries are just like they were when they were kids. You know, they had, books and maybe a computer in the corner. It's a very different world out there now. It's a lot more in the community, a lot more professional development, especially for younger people. I think that having access to Medici TV's streaming library for free is an incredible way to get classical music out there to younger people and people who wouldn't otherwise, you know, seek it out necessarily. I don't know how they're advertising this, but
yeah, I was going to say the hard part is going to be getting people to know that this is there,
right?
And getting people to figure out that they can access it, because libraries do not have the greatest marketing budgets in the world. I mean, there are lots of people who work at them who are actual saints and do the most that they possibly can with the least that they are possibly given. But
well, here's something: if you're listening right now and you're in the United States and you do not have a library card. I would encourage you, whether you intend to use this service or anything at the library, you should still go to the library and get a library card, because the numbers of people signing up for new library cards helps drive funding into local libraries. And even if you never, ever use it, that is funding that can be taken advantage of by an unhoused person who needs to use the computer to, write up a job application, or, you know, a young person who needs an after-school program who otherwise wouldn't get it, you know, or someone who just needs some classical music in their lives. And, you know, I think all the three of those things are important, and it's very easy to do, and it's free. Just walk in and do it. You never have to look at it again, but I recommend that you do.
Good call, bad call on Opera Box Score.
Good call, bad call to wrap things up as we head into yet another week of March Madness on the next show. But we got some good calls and some bad calls. First, we're going to start with Matt Cummings.
Okay, so this is not technically opera, but it is drama of an operatic scale, which is, I'm sure that I don't have to tell anyone listening to this, that there might have been a little bit of a kerfuffle regarding a certain Princess of Wales and her disappearance from public life, and the ensuing deluge, shall we say, of conspiracy theories about her absence. The Think Piece Industrial Complex ran into overdrive trying to get people to feel ashamed for having speculated online about where she could have possibly been. And those people completely do not get what that speculation was about, which is that we do not trust Kensington Palace. And, you know, honestly, a lot of the questions are still unanswered, which is, why did they throw a woman who they apparently knew was diagnosed with cancer under the bus by claiming that she was the one who digitally manipulated a family photo on Mother's Day? Like, it just does. It still doesn't really make sense, add up. This is a public-facing role. I wish nothing but the best for her and her family and a speedy recovery and a comfortable convalescence. But if your first reaction was just to write off everything that anyone said about it as we should be ashamed of ourselves, you are missing the point.
Weston Williams.
My bad call is getting canceled by monarchists for Matt's speech.
Let them come. Lavalogs don't mean anything here, baby.
I have a very good call. A while ago, I don't remember when this exactly happened. It might have been over a year ago now. But the LA Philharmonic released a press release that said that their deaf-friendly Fidelio is going to go on tour, which I was extremely excited about. If you don't remember, it was a collaboration with Deaf West Theater. The opera features deaf actors as well as singers, and they perform in sign language for both deaf and hearing audiences together. They're going to take this sort of semi-stage production and basically put it out all over the place, which I think is really, really exciting because this is something I'm very passionate about. You know, accessibility in opera is always, you know, something that is of prime importance to me. And Fidelio is such a good vehicle for those kinds of things. You know, you often see people trying something like that with Fidelio because it's such a message about freedom and triumph of the human spirit over adversity. And this is, I think, this is great. This is something that should not be relegated to just LA. It does need to go on tour. And I want to see more stuff like this, where you have a mixing of differently abled audiences together experiencing something together in ways that they might have never expected to experience. And it's really exciting. They're going to Barcelona, Paris, London, all over the place. And that's just a really good call for me.
And of course, an opera written by Beethoven, a composer who himself would go deaf.
Exactly, exactly.
Oh. Ashley Hardgrave.
So I'm usually the only one who does non-opera references, Matthew Cummings, but I guess what? I'm still going to do non-opera references. So I've been recovering from this jet lag, and so I've had to basically just sort of park myself in front of the TV and do nothing so that my brain can reset and remember what continent I'm on. On BBC Two, there is a show called The Repair Shop. Now, this is not new. It's been on since 2017. Lay off me. I just found it. But basically, the gist is there's this like series of cottages in rural England that are, you know, they have these professional craftspeople and artisans there. And people will bring in family heirlooms for them to restore. Mm. It's like it's like a hug. It's just like the sweetest, most wonderful. Did I watch it on the way back from my flight? Yes. Did I cry and did the stewardess check on me to make sure I was okay? Yes, that absolutely happened.
Better watch out. Arts Council England is going to find some way to defund it.
So, a delightful show which just closed at the Goodman Theater here in Chicago. It's directed and adapted by Mary Zimmerman, director who actually would be really great on our podcast. It's called The Matchbox Magic Flute. It's a two-hour condensation of Mozart's opera in English for five instrumentalists and 10 performers. It is utterly delightful and totally sweet. And it is going to Shakespeare Theater Company in Washington, D.C. in May and June. So if you're out there in our nation's capital, you might have a chance to catch Matchbox Magic Flute. That's it for this week's edition of America's Talk Radio Show about opera. Make sure you subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts, get your voice heard, and find links to stuff we've talked about at the website, operaboxscore.com. That's also where you can put your money where our mouths are. Just give back to the OBS using the Support the Team tab. Your announcer, Norm Waddell. Your creative consultant, Oliver Camacho. Your audio editor, Weston Williams. For my co-hosts Matt Cummings and Ashley Hardgrave with guest Lucas Meacham, I'm George Cedarquist, asking you to continue the conversation about opera despite technical difficulties. We're back with an all-new show next week. We continue the march of madness in opera land. Plus, you get more opera headlines, more hot takes, and more fully employed septuagenarians. Join us.